Talk given Saturday, 10th March 1973. You may recollect that last time, towards the close of our meeting, we considered some fundamental points in connection with the two most important words in the whole of the Upanishads, namely Brahman and Atma. These two words, as I tried to explain, represent realized transcendence. Also, the two words mean identically the same thing. And you remember, I explained how and why they represent the same thing. These words were the answers to two fundamental questions. What is ultimate reality? Who am I? Those are the two questions. The first was answered with the word Brahman, the second with the word Atma. And you remember, I explained that they were declared to be an identity because the way in which they realized was by going into themselves, emptying the mind, denuding the mind completely of all concepts, of all conditioning, of all theories, and so on, until finally there was only a state which was utterly lucid, which was pure consciousness itself. This is how it has been put in the Upanishads too. And because the answers to both questions were obtained in the same way, and led to the same final condition, Brahman and Atma were declared to be an identity. Now it is extremely interesting to observe that in Buddhist philosophy, it is not the positive assertion of Atma, but the negative statement of anatma, anatta, which plays a dominant part. Now, in order to understand this with a mind that is free of preconceptions and assumptions, let us recall something which the Buddha says in that famous autobiographical discourse of his, the Ariya Pariyesana Sutta. He says, monks, realizing that that which is born is subject to sorrow, I sought the unborn, the utmost security from the bonds, Nibbana. And I won the unborn, the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana. He repeats the same thing, substituting for the word unborn, the unaging, the undecaying, the undying, the sorrowless, the stainless. Now this was ultimate reality as presented in language by the Buddha. Now, if we look at some of the early Upanishads, the earliest particularly, Brihadaranyaka, Chandogya, Taittiriya, and so forth, we find statements of this sort. That is the Atma which is free from evil, ageless, deathless, sorrowless, hungerless, thirstless, whose desire is the real, whose conception is the real. That is the Atma that should be sought and understood. Now this statement recurs several times throughout the Upanishads. Now if you consider that statement and put it side by side with the Buddha's statement as to what he sought, is there any difference between seeking the unborn, unaging, undying, undecaying, sorrowless, stainless, and saying that the Atma is that which is unborn, undying, unaging, sorrowless, stainless? See, this is one of the points which has never received sufficient consideration. But better than consideration would be so to live the holy life that one actually becomes that utterly transparent, lucid center, or shall I say nexus, through which transcendence functions unhindered. Now let us look at another meaning, which is a very real meaning for these two words, Atma and Brahman. A little while ago I said pure consciousness, absolute consciousness. In the Varaha Upanishad, which is one of the very little known ones, Varaha Upanishad, you will find it stated that Atma and Brahman are the same, and that consciousness which is absolutely full, which is changeless, which is eternal, that is the meaning of the word Atma. But you see, the word used there is consciousness. Now I put it this way. When you yourself are truly still and silent, with the mind utterly emptied, in the total absence of isolative self-consciousness, you are in the unresisting state, and transcendent energy functions through you absolutely unhindered. That is the state which is the meaning of the word Atma or Brahman. Of course, an intellectual will say, ah, but that's phenomena. That's in the realm of phenomena. Yes, indeed, it is in the realm of phenomena. You are in a certain state in which transcendence realizes itself through you. It's not you who realize transcendence. You have achieved nothing. What you have succeeded in doing is to be totally absent from yourself. The organism is there, But that organism offers no resistance whatsoever to the reality of the transcendent shining through you. Obviously, it is something which is utterly indescribable. No words, no thought forms, thought shapes can contain this, which is the total reality. Experienceable by man, affirmable by man, but totally indescribable by man. This is the reality of Brahman or Atma. This which happens because you, a living being, are in that condition. This is the meaning of the ultimate samadhi of the Hindus, the asampranyata samadhi. The union with God without mediation, Ruysbroeck talks of it. This is what the Buddha called the state of cessation. Now, after this, later on in some future meeting, we will go a little bit more deeply into anatta, therefore, and what anatta might mean. For the present, we will try to understand our Upanishads, because they play perhaps a part of dominant importance as far as the background to the Buddha is concerned. Now, Yajnavalkya, who is one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers, in one of his wonderful expositions in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, states this as the conclusion. He uses the personalistic expression, doesn't say it. Sometimes he says it, sometimes he says he. In this case he says he because the term which has a subjective flavor, Atma, is what he is expounding. Therefore he says he. When he is talking of Brahman, he uses the term it. He is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the ununderstood understander. Other than him, there is no seer. Other than him, there is no hearer, no thinker, no understander. He is the Atma, the inner controller, immortal. This is how Yajnavalkya puts it. As far as the personalistic presentation is concerned. Then in another discourse in which one of the great women of the age rises up and asks him a question. The question which she asks is this. That, O Yajnavalkya, which is above the sky, which is beneath the earth, which is between these two, sky and earth, that which people call the past and the present and the future, across what is it woven, warp and woof? Across Akasha, O Gargi. Now, you know, we have gone into this meaning of the word Akasha not so very long ago. Usually it is translated as space. It is also used to denote the sky. In the modern languages in India, when we look up at the sky, we call it the Akasha. you see. Now space is correct as far as the linguistic aspect is concerned, but it is wholly misleading where the reality of Akasha is concerned. Akasha is mind space. That's its real meaning. Mind space is immeasurable. It has no length, no breadth, no depth. There is nothing that moves in mind space from one position to another position. There is no such thing, therefore, as velocity. Even the velocity of light doesn't apply to mind space. To give a trivial example, if you say, oh, that distant galaxy, what has your mind done? It's devoured perhaps 2,000 million light years distance in ordinary, what we call space, in our usual physical sense mind experience. You see? So this Akasha is better regarded as partly as the void as a measureless container. It contains life, not life in the biological sense, this something which creates. It contains prana, in other words, Akasha contains prana. The two really are interchangeable, somewhat after the style of Brahman and Atma. And this prana is the plenitude. Akasha is the void, and prana is the plenitude, out of which emerges the total universe. But don't interpret this statement as a scientific type of statement. It is a metaphysical statement. We'll go into it perhaps a little bit later. So this is Akasha. And Gargi, the woman who asks, is answered by Yajnavalkya by the word Akasha. That which is above the sky, beneath the earth, between these two, that which is called the past, the present, and the future. Across what is it woven? It's woven across mind space. So you see, what we commonly call distance, time, quantity, and so forth, finitude, and all the rest of it, is in an extraordinary way completely rooted in, subsumed in, and related to, in a manner which is so difficult to understand, leave alone explain, related to this mind space. That which we experience is related to that which is beyond description. Adoration to you, Yajnavalkya, in that you have solved this question for me. Across what then, she asks, is Akasha woven, warp and woof? Now note very carefully. We are already in a realm which is ethereal enough. But she asks, across what is Akasha woven, warp and woof? And then this is one of the grandest sections out of several very grand sections in the Upanishads. That, O Gargi, Brahmins call the imperishable, akshara. Kshara is perishable, akshara is the imperishable. It is not coarse, not fine, not short, not long, not glowing, not adhesive, without shadow and without darkness, without air and without space, without stickiness, intangible, odorless, tasteless, without eye, without ear, voice, wind, energy, breath, mouth, personal or family name, unaging, undying, without fear, immortal, stainless, not uncovered, not covered, without measure, without inside, without outside. And then these two lines, which are really an extraordinary revelation, if you can ever touch the depth of this revelation. It consumes nothing so ever. No one so ever consumes it. Then there are two other magnificent statements, but you can read the Upanishads for yourselves. I'll read the last one here. Verily, O Gargi, that imperishable is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the ununderstood understander. Other than it, there is naught that sees. Other than it, there is naught that hears. Other than it, naught there is, naught that thinks. Other than it, there is naught that understands. Across this imperishable, O Gargi, is Akasha woven, warp and woof. It is, I think it really is difficult to excel, even in verbal expression, the sentence of transcendence which is conveyed by such words. It's quite extraordinary. You must meditate and meditate. And not for a week or a month or a year or 10 years, but for a whole lifetime, and never cease meditating on things like that. Now, in this connection, there is another statement which occurs several times throughout various Upanishads. And that statement is this. Talking of Brahman or Atma, they refer to it as that from which speech and mind return, not having attained. Now remember, they have already presented mind not only in the sense in which we in the ordinary way understand mind, but in its transcendent aspect too. Mind has its transcendent aspect. I have to keep on using the word transcendent unless I follow the practice of Dionysius the Areopagite and say super transcendent or super super transcendent. But that lands us into absurdity. Therefore, I shall just use the word transcendent in both instances. They have presented the knowledge of the transcendent aspect of the mind. And beyond this, they say that this transcendent aspect does not touch that other transcendence, which is the ultimate statement they could make. They couldn't say anything more than that. That is why I have tried to put it this way, that when you yourself are completely still and silent, the mind utterly emptied, transparent, utterly pure, you are unresisting, then in that state, transcendence in its supreme sense functions through you. It is that from which speech and mind both return. Now, last time I explained in some detail the meaning of the word Purusha, which is translated as person. I will only give the essence of it again. The Purusha, the person talked of in this context, is one in whom all evil-mindedness is completely burnt out. Now, how does one move along in order to understand something of this transcendent reality? This is what is said in the Amrita Bindu Upanishad, a very little known Upanishad. Having studied the books, the scriptures, well, the learned man should persevere studiously in the acquisition of wisdom, of self-knowledge, and the self-realization that accrues from such self-knowledge. Then he should discard the whole of the books, as a person in quest of grain gives up the straw. So the books are as straw. Now that doesn't mean that you can burn all your books and say, hurrah, no more study for me, I can just do what I like. Well, try doing what you like, and what is happening in the world today is a wonderful example of what happens by people who live by that criterion of life. Note carefully, having studied the books, having persevered studiously in obtaining wisdom, self-knowledge, when all that is there, then discard the books. Let me quote one other statement by Yajnavalkya when he is talking to Kahola Kaushitekaya. The Atman is that which transcends hunger and thirst, sorrow and delusion, old age and death. Those Brahmins who have known that Atma, who have overcome the desire for children, the desire for wealth, the desire for worlds, live the life of mendicants. That which is the desire for sons is the desire for wealth. The desire for wealth is the desire for worlds. W-O-R-L-D-S. For both these are but desires. And he ends up by saying, aught else than the Atma is wretched. Now, let us consider very carefully this aspect of the living of the holy life. Purification we understand, particularly where the moral aspect is concerned. Where the intellectual side is concerned, It means that we have to free ourselves from our biases, prejudices, preconceptions, assumptions, and all our mental conditioning from the time we were born. Then again, there is that other aspect of the living of the holy life. The practice of mindfulness, of watchfulness, which affects not only the purification, but also releases in us the power to meditate, which means not just to take a subject of meditation and think upon it, but which means, in its deep sense, to be in communion with reality, with the truth of things as they are in the immediate now, from moment to moment. That is the real meaning of meditation. Obviously, a 24-hour business every day. Now, in the process of meditation, of mindfulness, one begins to be free of the limitations imposed upon our awareness by our sense discursive mind functioning. All our life is practically confined to the functioning of the senses and the operation of the discursive mind, whose principal instrument is speech, the flow of words. Now, when one becomes more and more mindful, more and more quiet, the sense functioning goes on, but it is completely pacified. It is at peace. The discursive mind ceases to keep chattering, and particularly to talk back at what the senses convey to it. So there is no state of conflict with the world, with the becoming process from moment to moment. There is no play of our conditioned criteria and standards of judgment. One enters more and more profoundly into a state of pure observation. This observation ultimately gets to that condition where the separate self-conscious I am I is out of the picture. The observer and the observed in awareness are one and the same. Now, when this happens, one is ready, one is in actual fact entering into those very, very profound states of meditation, the deep states of consciousness in the real sense, where you have completely transcended all the limitations imposed upon you by the functioning of the special senses, sight, hearing, etc. Thereby, the deeps of the mind are activated. And do remember that in this condition, it is no longer a case of talking of my mind. It is a meaningless term. It's mind, the one and only universal mind, just as ordinarily space is the one and only universal space. The inner depths of the mind get activated. And their functioning, their activity, is never known by you in discursive thought, that is to say, verbalized thought terms. So don't think that you will know something marvelous, not at all. In our ordinary everyday meaning of the term. In our ordinary everyday meaning of the term, the most marvelous things are just precisely what the senses convey to us. But in man there is this dormant potentiality. And it is this which emerges and becomes active in the ones whom we call the holy ones. Through their purification, through the stilling of the entire psychophysical activity, not suppression, do remember that. It's not a suppression, it is a complete stilling. And then these inner depths of the mind become active. They function. A sensitivity within your own being grows. You can't measure that growth. You can't see it grow. It grows until there comes the point when every possibility of phenomenal manifestation and the limitation consequent upon it is absent in awareness. I'm deliberately using the term awareness now as distinct from consciousness. Consciousness is always associated quite justifiably with I, the seeing subject, am conscious of you or that, the observed object or person. See? It's you're entering into that state of awareness which is really the transcendent condition. But this is still in the realm of mind, of pure mind. There comes the point when even this is a limitation and you get beyond it. Don't ask me how. It's totally indescribable. But this is what does happen. And that is why the Upanishads have this statement, which I believe does not occur in any other religious writing. The Atma or Brahman is that from which speech and mind return, not having attained or found. Because there is no finding possible here. There is no thing to find. This is the nature of transcendence. Now, you will find in all the scriptures of the world accounts of the creation. And the written accounts of necessity are in material terms. They start off with in the beginning, the phrase or the word in the beginning. And of course, God or Brahman or Atma did so and so, and this, that and the other appeared. And we immediately translate them to fit in to our limited mode of awareness. Of that is to say, of in terms of that which is conveyed to us and experienced by us through our senses and our discursive mind using language as its tool. And all language, apart from a very few words, is confined to the limited, the particular, the finite, which can be observed, experienced through the senses. There is also, of course, that sphere which has emerged, especially through mathematics, science, and all the rest of it, whereby by the use of pure intellect, and of course a speculative philosophy, by the use of pure intellect, one produces a world of thought on its own, which is so abstract that it seems to be quite unrelated to the sense world in which we live. But that is not actually the case. You will find that the most abstract philosophy of the world has, apart from the philosophy that has emanated, or rather, apart from the statements that have emanated from the holy ones themselves, and then they are no systematized philosophy. All the other philosophies are related to our concrete experience of matter, as we call it. Now, as one gets free of all this and enters into that other state, realizes transcendence, and then starts coming back to this state of consciousness, differentiation comes into being. In transcendence itself, there is no differentiation. There is no measurement. There is no quantity. There is nothing which is of the nature of mortality, which begins, proceeds, dies, birth and death. And the wheel of birth and death, if you like, they are completely out in transcendence. But on returning step by step to the ordinary state of consciousness, all the limitations which are associated with purely intellectual processes, and then later on with the sense processes, all begin to operate again, and description comes into being. Now, where the operation of the deeps of the mind is concerned, what the mind senses, is sensitive to, I don't mean senses in the ordinary way, but is sensitive to, is the activity of what we call the archetypal energies of mind. The archetypal energies. These archetypal energies have been presented anthropomorphically, of course, in terms of the archangels, angels, the angelic and the demonic orders, and so forth. It is a way of talking about the anabolic and catabolic energies of mind on its own plane. Not the anabolic and catabolic play of the energies that we in the world of matter and of, through scientific research are acquainted with. So they call them archangels, angels, etc., etc. Then analogically, they relate them to that which is conveyed by the senses. And so your first chapter of Genesis is written in the way that is written. There is the mention of fish and birds and all the rest of it. And in the first chapter, finally man. In the second chapter, it starts the other way around. Man comes first. Have you noticed that? It's the most interesting thing. And all the others enter upon the stage afterwards. Now, in the Upanishads, talking of creation, he starts off he starts off by saying that the Atma, which looking around saw no other than himself, said, "I am." Then there was fear. There was the sense of loneliness. These are the words in which it is put. Neither fear nor loneliness, of course, was experienced by anybody. But how else can they talk about? Could they have talked about it 30 centuries ago? Don't forget that, you see. And they say that he, the Atma, was the size of a man and a woman put together. And the original teaching, remember, was an oral teaching. And the person expounding it must have made a gesture. And he said that this space was occupied by a woman, and they fell apart. The two separated and became man and woman. And thus came into being Pati, the husband, and Patni, the wife. You see? Then they say that he copulated with her. She became a mare, he became a stallion. She became all the female things that exist, and he the male counterpart. You see? And thereby the world was produced. But this is a somewhat crude linguistic way of trying to suggest that the entire process of the emergence of the archetypal energies and the way they function was in terms of the interaction of positive and negative energy. That's how we would state it in our own terms today. The Kabbalah, and I'm now referring to the original Kabbalah, the unwritten one which existed before the days of Abraham, just like the original Veda, of which there is no written record, the Vedas that we have are only little bits of what that original Veda was, but the tradition, the oral tradition remains, and I'm talking of that, you see. The original Kabbalah and the original Veda were well aware of the whole process. That is to say, their own personal realization. And they presented in their esoteric teachings, in their own secret schools, how the knowledge of how the great archetypal energies function. Now you might say, well, what is the point in knowing all this? Haven't we got enough problems to get on with? Yes, of course we have. But all our problems are also related to that particular type of knowledge. Why? Because through this becoming process that we see unfolding in the world, those archetypal energies are moving it towards a great fulfillment and a fruition. Now, the functioning of those archetypal energies has been successful, more or less anyway, as far as the various kingdoms of nature are concerned on this planet. But with man, she has not been very successful. They have not been very successful yet. But we must bear in mind that man is very young. He has started, man as we know him, this organic body, living body, which is descended, which has evolved from some animal source, has its influence upon the whole process. And it's a retarding influence in the sense that it is an influence which produces conflict where man made in the image of God, that is in terms of a divine conception in the realm of archetypal energies, took place. Now the two have coalesced in man. They haven't harmoniously joined up. This is the point. This is why we have all this struggle and this conflict. If you compare the whole thing to a tree, and the tree symbolism is a very favorite symbolism, both with all that has emanated out of the Kabbalah and what has emanated out of the Veda, the other kingdoms of nature are lateral branches of this tree. They are all right, but man is the main central thing, the central trunk, going upwards. Now look, a tree has its roots in the earth. And the main root goes towards the center of the earth. It is earthbound. But man, who is the upside-down tree, in his case, the brain is the root, and the spine and the nervous system are the branches and the trunk spreading the other way around. Now, it is in man, it is the root which goes up, 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 up and throws out rootlets. But there is no center towards which that movement can take place. The earth is a limited thing. It has a center, a real physical center. But this has no limits. So you see, the development and the fruition of man implies the joining up of infinity, the non-finite, the absolute instead of the relative, with the finite and the relative. This is the extraordinary miracle that is taking place through man. Who has been able to conceive, at least intellectually, infinity? That is to say, his conception doesn't go very much further than merely contradicting finitude. But in the very fact that he has the ability to contradict finitude means that he has it in him to open up a totally new dimension of consciousness and being. Now, since man's potentiality is of this nature, he grows upwards towards infinity, and it is, instead of the branches of his being growing downwards more and more, because they can't, the surface of the earth prevents him, his root, the mind, the brain and the mind itself, goes up into the infinite, the absolute, the perfect, the immortal. Now you see, those old people understood the part played by this inner aspect of mind, this transcendent aspect of mind, and the archetypal energies which are there. And I use the term archetypal energies because there are obviously several broad modes in which they manifest in us. To take just a simple example, the spiritual values of love, wisdom, truth, and so forth, in their absolute sort of nature, these are expressions of that archetypal energy at play. Now, these old holy ones, they knew about all this. When they therefore came back to ordinary consciousness from that state of transconsciousness, of the state of realized transcendence, they talked about the creation of all these worlds. You find it in all the religions of the world. And the worlds referred to, of course, are these things which come out of the mind of man. So, actually, it isn't an external god or power which creates all these things. You, returning from that state of awareness, of transcendent awareness, raise up this entire creation. That is to say, you give expression to what is an actual experiencing by you of the profundities of the mind unknown to us in our ordinary everyday life. And this is really the real meaning of the creation, which you find in the scriptures of the world. So you can see what those holy ones must have realized in order to produce all this. It's not too easy to explain. I've tried somehow to present some sort of a picture. Perhaps I may have made confusion worse confounded by talking about it all. But I hope that perhaps it has helped some of you at least in some way or other to get a glimpse and to see a new kind of approach towards the understanding of these profound realities. The implication, therefore, is that we must learn to be free of our intellectual conditioning. This is where the difficulty comes. We must, on the one hand, not be gullible and swallow the words which have already been written, or which I have said, or anybody else says. Just as on the one hand we must not be credulous, on the other hand we must not be stupidly incredulous. You see? We must be completely open-minded, receptive, sensitive, and then remain balanced, really balanced in mind. And then that inner sensitivity will enable us to make the right response to what we learn.